This is the Freshman 15.
I'm Jeremy Bear, and I might not be the hero this podcast deserves, but I'm the hero. No, I might not be the hero that this pod. No, I might be the hero Gotham wants. Okay.
My name is Daniel Long, and I've actually cloned myself hundreds of times, but the other versions of me are locked away in chambers of water.
So, Daniel, welcome back, by the way.
I'm back.
Hey, man, listen, and you were missed.
I missed being here.
Our audience, many of which I'm sure heard our Oscar special.
They didn't hear me.
They didn't hear you, brother.
But here's what I have to say about that, and I posted this on Facebook, but I meant every word. It was really wonderful being a listener. To listen to people talk about great films.
It was a fun time, but I got to tell you, it's good to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
And I do want to get full bore into the episode, but before we do, email.
Yeah, we have some.
All right, lay it on me, dude.
Okay. This is a great email, by the way. This is from our friend Pete.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, just finished the David Lynch episode. I'm not a big Lynch man myself, but as an ardent fan of Twin Peaks, I was intrigued to listen. I must say that I felt a little put off by your agonizing over the question of what comprises an art film. I will admit that this all piqued my curiosity a bit, but in spite of your best efforts, I don't think I'm any more inclined to watch Eraserhead now than I was when I first started listening to the episode.
Well, touche, Pete.
My question is, which David Lynch movie might be the best starting point for someone like myself who won't get anywhere near Eraserhead? I like the distinction that Jeff made about a movie feeling like work. With that in mind, which David Lynch movie is the least laborious? And I'm glad to have you guys back. Keep up the good work, Pete.
Well, thank you, Pete, for your notes, and thank you for your obvious cynicism.
Yeah, I mean, what do you call that?
It's crotchety, really, is all
totally.
It is.
Which, if you know Pete, makes sense. It's a crotchety laced with love, right?
Pete, sincerely, we do appreciate your note. Pete is not the only person who, following that episode, expressed that same sentiment,
right.
Which is, okay, I don't think that I'm wooed into watching Eraserhead based on your description, which I appreciate that.
Yeah, totally.
You know? Okay, then we're not here to win you over to Eraserhead, but the same question, though. So what should I start with?
So this is a really hard question because, like, if I was to suggest, you know, one of my favorite Lynch movies, because I would say, okay, Mulholland Drive.
Sure.
That gives you a good taste of the rest of Lynch's work, but I don't know if you'd want to watch any more of Lynch's work.
Yeah, but you know what, though? I feel like Lynch is the type of artist that I don't necessarily think that he is for everybody.
That's true.
And you know, Pete, it sounds like you like Twin Peaks. That tells me that, you know, you probably would have a little bit of investment in a number of different Lynch films, but... Yeah, it's entirely possible that the guy's just too weird. And I hate to be that reductive, but there's a certain investment that it requires, and that's just not why everybody goes to the movies.
It's true, but if I was to say, Pete, you should go watch The Straight Story.
Right.
And Pete watched it and loved it.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to watch more Lynch.
Then go see more. Well, you know what? I'm going to go back to my old faithful, and I'm gonna say it's still probably my favorite Lynch film. Going back a couple of Halloweens ago, The Elephant Man.
Yeah.
If you're trying to dip a toe into the water of Lynch, I think that, you know, you could do a lot worse than The Elephant Man. It's chilling piece of work. It's heartbreaking. It's beautiful. It's not weird you out weird. It's just, it's a fairly straight narrative, but it also gives you a taste of a little bit of that Eraserheadness, mm-hmm. You know?
It does.
Without being maybe so abstract, for lack of a better word. But I don't know, Pete, if you haven't already, go watch Elephant Man. I think you'll thank me.
Thanks for taking the time to send us an email.
Yeah, we really do appreciate it. So, anyhow, I don't know, man. You want to go for it here?
I'm ready.
Let's do it.
How can I explain it? You ever been to a football match, just let your eyes... go over, drift across a crowd of people, and they slowly stop and fix on one person, and all of a sudden that person isn't part of the crowd anymore. They become an individual, just like that. Just became irresistible.
So you followed women?
No, I didn't follow women. It wasn't a sex thing. I followed anybody. I just wanted to see where they went, what they did. It was supposed to just be completely random. And when it stopped being random, that's when it started to go wrong.
So Daniel, speaking of emails, and specifically speaking of emails from our old friend Pete, this is not the first note that we've gotten from Pete.
It's not.
In fact, the last note that we read was back in our 15th episode, which was our big bonanza Stanley Kubrick episode, in which Pete asked a number of questions, but in there he worked a reference to the episode that he was hoping would be coming, a Christopher Nolan episode, which, here we are.
Here we are, following.
Following.
Christopher Nolan's freshman film.
Yeah.
1998.
Black and white film.
Yep.
You're probably living under a rock if you haven't heard of Christopher Nolan. He's definitely one of the premier directors, and he occupies that interesting kind of space where he's this intellectual artist, but at the same time, he's also responsible for some of the biggest budget blockbusters we have. And he's that kind of crossover director guy that everyone, for the most part, seems to agree, oh, wow, this is a great director. And it's not to say that you like everything Christopher Nolan has ever done, but he has this sort of universally respected air about him, I guess, when people are talking about what are the great films and the great filmmakers.
And there isn't a better time to talk about Christopher Nolan than right now. I mean, as you guys mentioned in the Oscar special, right? Nominated Dunkirk for Best Picture, nominated for Best Director. I mean, here's a guy who is making a statement, but not necessarily quote-unquote Oscar bait movies.
Yeah, you don't get the sense, at least I don't, that he's necessarily trying to hook the Academy or something. He's interested in making the types of films that interest him. And thank goodness, because they interest me too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so here we are with Following, going back to the beginning. But I think before we talk about it, should we offer a premise for the film?
I think it's appropriate. And it's really interesting with Following, because it occurs to me that I've noticed sometimes listening back through some of our episodes, we tend to make the same comment a lot, which is, I mean, it's a fairly simple movie, but .. Following, I don't know that I can call it a simple movie.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot going on in this movie, but yeah, I think starting with a premise is appropriate.
Okay, I'm going to give this a shot. There's a man, he follows people for the purposes of wanting to see what they do and how they act. You don't get this vibe that it's perverse in that way. It's certainly voyeuristic. He finds himself following this person who we later learn is named Cobb, and Cobb basically calls him out on what he's doing. Cobb is a thief, breaks into people's houses, and basically invites and teaches him his trade. There's a woman involved, and going any further is going to kind of give away some of the important plot pieces of the film, which maybe we want to. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, not that we're trying to be spoiler-free with our discussions of these films, but suffice it to say, and I think this is an important point, that, you know, this young man, he's a writer, and he's looking for inspiration. That's why he's following all these characters around London. And when this Cobb character finally catches him in the act, and they fall in together, and they start this sort of two burglars relationship together where they're going around making mischief, a really interesting psychological thing starts to happen, where how much is this young man being manipulated? How far-reaching does this web go, and how many shady characters are involved, and who knows what? And I suspect that the story would seem much simpler if Christopher Nolan weren't doing the typical Christopher Nolan thing, which is telling the story completely out of order.
And I think that's one of the things that you almost have to get into immediately when you're trying to premise a Nolan film, is how do you talk about a Nolan film without talking about what he's doing with sequence and time and narrative?
It's hard to not talk about the how when you're talking about the what, because they're so intertwined.
Yeah, I mean, if we were to try to premise Inception, how would you do that? Or, I mean, Memento, right?
Sure.
And so now we're kind of getting into the conversation of what makes a Nolan film a Nolan film. But I really think that this is key to what he does as a filmmaker.
So do you remember when you first saw Following?
Yeah, so it would have been it's the second Nolan film I'd seen after Memento. So I'd seen Memento, brought it home, and watched that movie, I think, 3 times in 1 weekend. Just to kind of try to wrap my head around it. And so I was like, I need to watch some other films this guy has made. Well, at that point, there was only one other film.
So you saw Memento pre-Insomnia?
Yes. Okay. Saw Memento pre-Insomnia. But then I watched Following not too long after I was introduced to Nolan for the first time as a filmmaker.
Right.
What about you?
In my memory, it's close to the time that I saw Insomnia. I can't remember if it was before or after, but same. Saw Memento in the theater when it came out.
That's awesome. I envy that.
Yeah. My wife and I were living in Columbus. There was a little art theater not far from where we lived, and it happened to be showing Memento. In those days, marketing through websites was kind of a thing that was still sort of new. Mm-hmm. And I loved the fact that the official Memento website was called otnamem.com.
Yes, I know.
I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember that.
Again, I can't remember how long I waited after seeing that, but I remember thinking the same thing. Christopher Nolan, okay, there's got to be other things by this guy. Went to the Blockbuster, I guess, rented Following, and it became immediately obvious that, oh yeah, I can see how this was the same guy. You can see the same affectations, yes, and the same interests, but definitely its own thing. And I remember walking away even then thinking, I'm going to watch everything this director ever does.
Right.
I've stumbled upon a really intelligent filmmaker.
Right. And I remember, it did not register with me immediately in terms of what was going on.
Yeah.
Like Memento, I felt like I instantly, there were a lot of nuances that I, of course, didn't get on the first watch. But after the first watch, I understood what was happening.
Yeah.
With Following, I'm thinking, okay, I don't know how all of these things fit together.
Yeah.
Watching it a couple times in preparation for this, where I had some aha moments that I did not have then. I love that about Nolan films.
Yeah.
Over time, as you re-engage a certain movie that he's made.
Yeah, and in fact, this is a comment Jeff made even on our Oscar special about Dunkirk. Leave it to Christopher Nolan to come up with a way to tell a fairly simple story in a way that complicates everything, but it complicates it in a way that actually engages you rather than pushes you away. It's still hard for me to look at something like Following like it's a simple story. Yeah. It just doesn't feel simple. Although there is an in-order cut that you can view if you have the criterion.
I heard about that. I haven't seen it. Have you seen it?
I didn't watch it. I think it would be an interesting experience. At the same time, though, I'm almost hesitant to, because I've seen the in-order cut of Memento, and it made me kind of wish I had never seen it, because it was so just straight and kind of dry when told in the correct order. It kind of took all the magic and intrigue away. So there's part of me that is interested, but I don't really know that I want that experience of watching Following in order, because I don't know, the bloom would be off the rose a little bit.
So here's one of my questions, thinking about Nolan, and we see it here in Following. Why complicate it?
Yeah.
He's wanting to do something, or maybe he's wanting to say something through the complications. I'm curious if you have any ideas or thoughts as to maybe why do that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's tied into my feelings about Following specifically in general and the career of Christopher Nolan. You know what? For me, Following is the quintessential freshman film. It was really interesting for me going back and watching Following, because I felt like for the first time in a long time, it made me re-examine the mission statement of this podcast. Of why are we talking about freshman films at all? What's the point? How is that a gateway into talking about the career of an artist, or all the different themes and stylistics, as we used to say, that are falling out of this director? We've talked about artists like Tim Burton, Ridley Scott, all these people that did these really impressive freshman films. But when you really look at their freshman film, it's their freshman feature, but it's not really their directorial debut.
Yeah.
And that's a really important distinction.
That is.
Ridley Scott, I mean, for heaven's sakes, if you think this is the first thing he ever directed, you're out of your mind. I mean, this thing is beyond the fact that it has clearly a very healthy budget and all these substantially fantastic actors. Ridley Scott had an entire career behind him of commercials, and, you know, Tim Burton had a whole career of doing animated shorts and all that. So when they come to their freshman feature, they're actually already fairly filled out. It's just a question of how they're going to handle this first feature. Christopher Nolan, on the other hand, this is a very special case. Now, he had some shorts in his repertoire.
So I didn't know this.
A handful of them, but it's him and his friends, and they're messing around, and that's it. Christopher Nolan was no one when he made Following. And I mean, he was no one. His day job was he made training videos. And he did the shooting, and he did sound editing for these training videos. And it was basically the most straightest, boring job you can have in film. But this thing was such a labor of love following that it was shot over the course of at least a year.
On weekends, right?
On weekends, exactly. And the reason that it was shot on weekends is because that's when his friends had free time, one. And for another thing, he didn't have the money to buy film stock to shoot more often than that. So that was essentially his life. He would work through the week, save up enough money to buy a little film stock, shoot a little footage that weekend, and then go back to work the next week to try and save up enough money for more film stock. And that was it. And so little bit by bit by bit, he put his film together. And it was, as he describes it, a no-budget film.
And I've always felt very strongly that every film you do, you can't ever view it as a stepping stone to making another film. You have to really enjoy the film for what it is and just do that. But at the time, it was really unheard of in England to do a no-budget film as such.
And, you know, you look at these other freshman films that we've talked about, and yeah, they're freshman films technically, but they're not really directorial debuts. This was Christopher Nolan's first shot, really kind of any kind, across the bow. And I realize this is a long wind around to talk about the topic you were bringing up before, but I think part of the reason that he told the story and the way that he told it, when you're in a position where you have no money and you have no credibility, you have no prospects, you have no anything, you focus your time and attention and your energy on the things that you can do that are free. And the things that Christopher Nolan realized that he could do to make this a premium product and a unique product and a way to get this in front of people and make them say, oh, well, now that's something I haven't seen before. I want to pay attention to this. Is he knew that if he were to treat the script in such a way that he could bring a whole new experience to his audiences, at least that's something. At least that's more than just him saying, see, look, I can play with the big boys. Christopher Nolan said, I'm not the play with the big boys guy. I'm an artist. I need to show people that I don't have any money, but at least I've got this. At least I've got a typewriter and I can think through things at a level that maybe most first time filmmakers are thinking like, well, I just, you know, I've got a camera and I just got to fucking shoot. I got to get some footage. Christopher Nolan said, no. I want to concentrate on what this is and the shape it is. And I want to bang this into something interesting before I even shoot a frame of film. So anyway, I apologize for this long diatribe, but that's how I picture the whole thing going.
That's great. It could be argued, I'm not making the argument, but I think it is out there that he made more interesting films, or at least told more interesting stories early on than he has continued to do, maybe with like bigger productions and things like that.
Yeah.
But what you bring up is, it makes me think that Nolan is a director who forces upon himself limitations.
Hmm.
The limitations were forced upon him here in Following. Certainly you have Memento, where the story itself, in terms of a person who cannot make memories,
right,
is itself a limitation. And how do you tell that story?
Right.
To something like Inception, in which he's, you know, how do you create this shot where people are floating and fighting and there's a gunfight in what feels like zero gravity, to Dunkirk and using real large set pieces or machinery. I mean, I don't think I've ever had that thought until you were saying, here's a director who's has all of these limitations with his first film. And it's almost as if he keeps trying to create those limitations for himself as he continues, which forces him to do things that no one else thinks to do, or maybe has the time to do, or even desires to do. I just think that's a really interesting.
Yeah, and I think a real staple of Christopher Nolan is he has more faith in his audience than I think just about any director I can think of. When you watch a Christopher Nolan film, he expects a lot of you. He expects you to be up to the challenge. When you buy a ticket to a Christopher Nolan film, he's kind of making a handshake deal with you, which is, I'm going to assume that you're an intelligent person and you're going to be able to handle the concepts that I'm throwing at you. And you're going to be able to handle the vehicle that I'm going to put all these ideas in. And not only am I going to do that, I'm actually going to even let you drive for a while. I'm not gonna hold your hand, and I'm not gonna explain everything in detail. I'm gonna let you wrestle with this. I think that goes back, certainly all the way back to Following. Yeah, the risk is this is just gonna frustrate people.
Right. I had a thought when I was watching Following that what Nolan is presenting or offering are puzzle pieces. But you don't actually have the box. You don't have the picture to look at.
Right.
You're trying to figure out how they fit, and you find a few that fit together through work. You discover something about yourself of being able to do that.
Yeah.
And that's one of when I was watching Following, it reminded me of watching Memento the first time, was somehow I felt like an awesome person. that I got it, right? Like, yeah. I see what's happening.
Yeah.
And I understand now how this works. I mean, I didn't do anything.
Right.
Nolan did it all, but I was a participant in that.
Yeah.
The same thing with Following, where you have, oh, okay, he's dressed differently here. He has longer hair here. His face has been beat to shit here.
Right.
Okay, I think I understand in my brain the sequence. And then obviously it moves into a place where you're like, oh, okay. And I just love that.
Yeah, that jigsaw puzzle piece quality is definitely something that's interesting. And this is something that I feel like carries into other films. Even if you don't reconstruct that puzzle in the exact same way every time, none of them are necessarily the wrong experience either. Mm-hmm. I remember particularly with Memento, you would debate at the end of the movie
right.
about different aspects of it. Just like, okay, well, I remember that one of the big debates people had was, can he actually make new memories? Is this something that, you know, you could make kind of a case either way? And I feel like there's similar things going on even with Following. I remember, you know, there's a plot line with a quote unquote bald man. I don't know how successful it would be, but you could kind of make a case either way that maybe there was no bald man, you know, maybe.
By the end, that's a good point. You could make that case.
You could make the case. Now, you know, there's parts of that that fall down. And the way that Nolan presents all this information to you invites that kind of scrutiny. Whereas if you were to tell just a straighter story, you probably wouldn't bother because it's not really tickling those parts of your brain where you're going to be like, you know, the story is the story. What am I, you know? But he's telling things. He's working inside the chronology of his stories. And this is definitely something that we see in nearly all of Nolan's films. He's obsessed with time and chronology. It's not always clear what is a flashback and what isn't. I think Nolan understands that sometimes the climax of a story isn't always at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You get to experience the crescendos at the time that he wants you to experience them. Dunkirk is a perfect example of that, actually. You don't always know where and what particular timeline you are. And it's not really even complicated, the story that's being told, but it's kind of massaging you into this mindset where you realize that if you don't stay on your toes, you're going to miss a whole lot. Of course, chronology isn't the only way he does that, but that's one of his main bag of tricks, I would say.
Yeah, and it's making me think that Nolan seems to do this trick constantly where he's making you rethink or reconsider what came before.
Right.
That's just a really interesting trick. And I don't mean to say trick as if it's a gimmick or it's something that I don't want to devalue that. Like it's something that I think he's intentionally doing. And I wonder if he's also making a comment about even the power of film and story in some way.
Yeah, you know, and I think it only works when you have someone who's not just a really articulate director, but also someone who is capable of not just really razor sharp writing, but also identifying really razor sharp writing. His partner in crime for most of his films, if not all of his films, maybe, is his brother Jonathan, mm-hmm. who is just this phenomenal conceptual thinker. Every script is really not just tight, but it's intelligent and it's spare where it needs to be and it's filled out where it needs to be. And that was something that goes all the way back to Following, honestly. I'm thinking of different conversations that you hear, maybe my favorite of which was the conversation that happens between Bill and Cobb the first time they meet in that diner.
Yeah.
That conversation is so sharp and it's almost noirish. It's stylized, but yet at the same time, it tells you what you need to know in a very clever way about both of these characters.
Well, you're obviously not a policeman, so who are you and why are you following me?
Sorry, I don't know what you're talking
about. Don't piss me about. Who the fuck are you?
Okay, to tell you the truth, I thought you were this guy that I was at school with. I saw you walk in here, so I followed you in just to see if it was him, but it wasn't.
Why didn't you just ask me when you saw me?
Because I'd have been embarrassed if it wasn't the person.
Not as embarrassed as you are now.
No, I suppose not.
What's your name?
Bill.
Well, Bill, what do you do?
Actually, I'm kind of...
Between jobs right now, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
What would you do?
Don't know.
Oh, come on, Bill, don't be coy. There's some burning ambition inside you, isn't there? Something of the starving artist in you, no?
No, no.
You're a painter?
No.
Photos?
No.
Writer?
No.
Writer, eh?
No.
But you write?
Not much.
But sometimes?
Sometimes, he doesn't.
Yeah.
That's a necessary character mm-hmm. for these sorts of films, because if your dialogue is stale, and your characters are just puppets to be able to tell this big concept stuff, then you've lost me. You've lost my investment. All I have to do is watch the first minute and a half of Memento, and I can't stop watching
right.
it. I mean, it's just, I'm in. And it's not just because, oh, isn't this interesting how this was put together. The noirish quality, Guy Pearce's performance,
yeah.
the naturalism of the language. Okay, I'm in a hospital. No, I'm in a hotel room. And there's a little bit of stream of consciousness to it, but it's so human.
Yeah.
And it would be easy in those kinds of moments to just sort of go expository, because I am having to teach my audience how to watch my movie while they're watching it. And it would be easy to pour all your energy into that, because you know that's where the investment mm-hmm. is. But Nolan doesn't do that. He still stays true to performance and character, refusing to handhold. You can't mistake a Nolan movie. You know it as soon as you see it.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know how he does that, and being able to conceptualize or work with others who conceptualize these wonderful stories
yeah.
and be able to accomplish it.
Yeah.
He uses all the different elements at his fingertips, even in Following, which I had not remembered. Like, sound is really important to the film.
Right.
Where do you think he starts? Do you think he starts with story, or do you think he says, you know, I'd like to tell this type of movie, and then finds a story or has a story written or writes a story? Where do you think he starts?
I mean, it's a good question. Where do these big ideas and these big concepts come from? I guess I picture him sitting in a room or sitting on the phone or hanging out with his brother, and then and the two of them just bouncing ideas off of each other about, like, what have you read recently? What's a concept that's hard to explain? How do we put a concept that's hard to explain on film? There's so many of his films that do exactly that. I mean, certainly Inception, you know, just what a mind-bending idea. Interstellar, mind-bending ideas on top of mind-bending ideas, and all based in theoretical, mm-hmm. but also fairly hard science. How do you relate the nature of reality and the different strands of possibility, the different timelines that
right.
are going on at the exact same time? How do you visualize something like that? Most directors would be like, okay, well, let me think about a cool special effect, or let me contact a special effects house or a production designer that's really going to make something look just crazy and incredible. And Nolan says, I don't really want to do that. I'd rather think through what's a way to actually make that look, not what's a way to make that look cool, but what's a way that to actually make it look like what we're actually talking about, you know? That's a really important distinction. He's so interested in, I guess, what I would call almost a documentarian's eye rather than a sweeping cinematic eye, you know? And he definitely has an eye for cinema. There's no doubt about it. I mean, for Pete's sake, he's,
yeah.
again, going back to Dunkirk, I want to say 60, 70% of the movie was shot on IMAX. I want to say for a major studio feature film is maybe the most,
wow,
the biggest percentage that's ever been shot on full IMAX.
Dunkirk, he's like, I want to shoot all large format.
70-something percent of the film is the full IMAX format.
The thing about the IMAX format is it's based on creating such a high-quality image that you get a very visceral and tactile sense of being there as things are unfolding.
You're so in it with the characters. There's really no barrier between you and them.
The huge challenge is the size and weight of the cameras. So our feeling was if we could find a way to do it physically, the payoff would be well worth it.
But those cameras are such a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Because these frames of film are so huge. If you look at his DP on Dunkirk, he's this big hulking guy because he has to be yeah. to carry this big freaking camera. Whatever the case. So he's definitely interested in cinematography and spectacle and all that. But he's even more interested in putting you in it. And I think that's part of the reason that, you know, there was this sort of renaissance in the 90s. Small budget, low budget, no budget mm-hmm. directors shooting exclusively in handheld. Handheld has had a strange relationship with movies over the decades. It would be easy for a lot of people, you know, in decades past to look at handheld and say, oh, well, see, there you go.
Right.
They clearly didn't have much money. They didn't have the dollies and the tripods and stuff. So it's just on someone's shoulder and it's quote unquote cheap. Mm-hmm. But there were certain directors coming along that was like, no, let's revisit that. It's true. We don't have any money and we can't really. Let's turn that, though, into an asset. Let's turn that into a feeling. And I'm not trying to say that Nolan is the first guy to ever shoot handheld. I mean, you know, for right. Pete's sake. Yeah. But he really was interested in making these stories feel like they were being done at more of a documentary level than a sweeping cinematic level. And what that does is it profoundly affects your own investment in the story as an audience member. You no longer feel like a story is happening to you or being done to you or even being told to you. You are now an active participant in that story. And it's not to say that every style of handheld cinematography does that, but when paired with the right storytelling techniques, that's exactly what it does. I think it's amazing that Dunkirk was shot largely handheld with these insane cameras. Now, not all of it,
right.
But he loves that feeling that you're in the room with a camera on your shoulder, and that's all through following. Yeah, it was a product of budget to a certain degree, but even more than that, I think, at least this is what I want to believe, is that he knew he was getting at a certain storytelling feeling with this handheld camera, and he didn't want to give that up, and he still doesn't want to give that up.
Yeah, and he does something too with that, even with the handheld camera, focuses on some like really, really specific details.
Yeah.
Like you have the hands in following. You actually have hands again in both Memento and Insomnia,
right.
Being very tactile with certain things. And I think part of that is to serve what you just said, which is it brings us into the film, but it also forces us to maybe consider things that we hadn't before thought were important. I mean, what a character does, right? And with their hands and their fingers can point to who they are.
Yeah.
And certainly these little details Nolan will use to great effect, not necessarily with something like fingers or hands, but I mean, The Prestige is all based on, are you a viewer who is paying attention?
Yeah.
So there's just all these things that I think he does to kind of pull us into the film,
yeah,
and to situate us there and say, okay, are you looking?
Right. I like the fact that you brought that thread up because that is honing in on so many different Christopher Nolan sort of themes and staples. Following, without a doubt, one of the going themes, at least this is one of the things that I walked away with, was how can you really know a person? How well can you get to know a person based on just their activities? How well can you get to know them based on just the crap that's in their house, the stuff that they've accumulated? You know, how many clues to who you are in all of these macro level things,
right.
You know? And I think Following makes the case that quite a bit, maybe, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, maybe it's possible to discern more than we're comfortable admitting. What would someone say about me if they were to look through, you know, my iTunes library or something like that? I mean, is that a picture of me? It kind of is. It's kind of an embarrassing one if I'm really thinking about it, though. I don't want people to know that I listened to that album 17 times in a row that, you know, that year. That's sick and that's sad and that's weird and that's gross, but that's me.
Katy Perry. Your fight song.
You're not able to judge me. No, but I mean, but it's true though. I want to curate a different version of me, then maybe I'm able to, you know? And it's so interesting that, that sort of thought and that kind of message might come across in a movie as intricate as Following and may speak to something that we're dealing with even more directly now than we were in the late 90s, is, you know, now that our curated lives are all on display. What can you find out by rooting through someone's Instagram account, you know, about them? Can you find out more than, I don't know, you would be able to if you were to just take a 5-minute trip through their bedroom or something? I don't even know where I'm going with this whole thread.
No,
I don't
it's
even know
so it great. I mean, it connects to one of the key things in the film, which is, you know, a cop says to Bill, which is everybody has a box.
Right.
The idea being people collect things and place these things in a box and where they hide somewhere. And he wants to find that thing and he wants to empty it so that somebody knows that they saw it and they found it, right?
Yeah.
I think that connects to what you're saying is we all have that.
Where's the box? What box? Everyone has a box. But mainly it's used for a shoebox.
Is there valuables in it?
No, more interesting, more personal. Things like snapshots, letters, little trinkets for Christmas, cracker. Each thing tells something very intimate about the people. We're very privileged to see it, it's very rare.
Hey, what the hell did you do that for?
That's what it's all about. Interrupting someone's life, making them see all the things that they took for granted. Like when they go back and buy all this stuff from the shelves with insurance money, they'll have to think for the first time in a long time why they wanted all this stuff, what it's for. You take it away, you show them what they had.
What is our box and what's in it? I mean, that's like one of the interesting questions I think we are left to wrestle with. Mm-hmm. And then also, what conclusions will people come to given what they find? It's not just who you are and how you're presenting yourself. It's also how people perceive what you're presenting.
Yeah. And there's of course the moment in the movie where the young man, does he have a broader agenda? Does he even know himself? Why he takes Cobb back to his own apartment to try and pretend that this is a mark that he's located to, you know, this would be a great place to burgle.
I just loved hearing that so often in the movie.
There's nothing worse than being burgled.
I know. I don't want to be burgled.
Yeah. But you can kind of see why he would want to do that, though. Why he would want to be like interested in this sort of free psychoanalysis that Cobb seems to be able to give to every single person whose apartment that he robs. You know, he's kind of like, I want to know what's apparent about me. Mm-hmm. If the same thing were to be applied to my stuff and my apartment, as I think many of us would assume, he was not thrilled with the answer.
Nice machine.
Maybe he's a writer.
Nah, if he's a writer, he'd have a word processor. This guy wants to be a writer. Those are two separate things. This guy's unemployed.
No, he's not.
Look at the desk. He's unemployed. People who have jobs don't have this kind of fucking shit in their homes. He's either unemployed or he's a student. And he's gonna be back any fucking second. What the fuck is that? I mean, you should recognize it, doll boy. It's fucking UB40, you fucking asshole. You haven't checked us out at all. We're going now.
I love that. I love the fact that he takes Cobb into his own place in order to essentially just psychologically eviscerate him. And I think on some level he knows that that is what's going to happen, but he does it anyway. You know, and he's trying to put out, Fleetwood Mac.
Yep.
Kind of a guy of taste, wouldn't you say? And Cobb cuts right through it.
Yeah, but it's so obvious. Interesting. And it says so much about who Bill is and what he's lacking and what he wants and why he can be so manipulated to an extent that he doesn't even see, right? Until it's really too late.
Yeah. I feel like we can't fully talk about Christopher Nolan without talking about the fact that, yeah, probably at this point, he may be best known for the guy who made 3 Batman movies. Mm-hmm. When I first heard that Christopher Nolan was taking on Batman, I remember actually being really conflicted about it.
Really? You felt like you didn't know what to think?
I didn't know what to think because I knew I loved Christopher Nolan and yes, I love Batman. I've always loved Batman. I've loved the comics and I've loved the movies. But I also knew on some level that Christopher Nolan was the type of artist, the type of director to throw a spotlight on what's most interesting and, you know, as we can even see and following, what's most embarrassing about our innermost crap.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I don't know that I want that to happen with Batman. Mm-hmm. You know, Batman was kind of this guilty pleasure, I guess, you know. But I thought, oh, I don't know that that level of honesty can be applied to Batman. And if it is, I'm just worried that it's going to make me not like Batman anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I know. That's
no.
So petty and dumb.
No, I mean, I remember something. I don't know if it was conflict or tension. So I remember thinking, okay, after Insomnia, which I love that movie. I think it's a
Insomnia.
I really like that movie a lot. But I was so taken by, you know, what he did in Memento, mm-hmm. and even what he was exploring in Insomnia. I didn't know if it would translate into the Batman world. Mm-hmm. Two thoughts. One was, oh, is he going to kind of give up the way I feel like he's been telling stories, which is so like in his own intricate kind of complicated way, and do something a little bit more mainstream or straight? Or is it just going to be something completely different that I don't, you know, even expect? So I felt like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to be getting, yeah. But I was nervous about it.
Yeah, I enjoyed all of the Batman movies to a degree. Put it this way, two of them are really good. I appreciate them for what they are. And I know that it was a big letdown for, you know, there's a lot of people that would argue that the DC Universe movies are not quite up to snuff,
mm-hmm.
certainly comparatively to other franchises. Christopher Nolan added this kind of, no pun intended, but prestige to the mm-hmm. to that universe of characters. And particularly with Batman, he seemed to be able to have a way of making us feel like we weren't idiots for liking Batman.
That's a great way to put it, I think.
Yeah, there's just been this decades-long quest to get this character, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. right. And I think we talked about with the Tim Burton episode that when that Batman, that version of Batman came along, the world was like, at last, we've mm-hmm. seen the way, you know, we're no longer the campy Batman. Now it's twisty, kind of funny, but also kind of gothic and, you know, very clearly Tim Burton-y Batman. And then, you know, from there, it just Joel Schumacher screwed this character up and, you know, and how dare you take this very serious property.
Right.
And I remember being intrigued when I heard about the Christopher Nolan Batman and thinking, you know, because no one seems to be able to play him completely straight, including Tim Burton. Even in Richard Donner's Superman, he couldn't help but do a little bit of winky-winky, you know, just like the comics and, you know, sort of a thing. Christopher Nolan was one of the first. Maybe you could also argue Bryan Singer's X-Men, but he was one of the first to just say, I am just without irony going to take this property completely seriously. Mm-hmm. There's not going to be any winks. There's not going to be any tongue-in-cheek or anything. We are serious about this. Someone who's pushed himself to be the best version of himself. He's funneled his own psychological issues and traumas into becoming the perfect instrument of justice, mm-hmm. and all that. And I'm going to tell the story of a guy who wears pointy things on his head so that he can look more like a bat in a serious way. You know, and I got to say, you have to take that takes such total commitment and such zeroed in focus in order to be like, no, I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go for the laugh, even though I'm putting a guy in an outfit like this. I'm not going to go for the laugh. And I don't know. I mean, there's a boldness to that I really appreciate.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I know why you choose to have your little group therapy sessions in broad daylight. I know why you're afraid to go out at night. The Batman.
What do you propose?
It's simple. We kill the Batman.
If it's so simple, why haven't you done it already?
If you're good at something, never do it for free.
I'll be the first to admit that The Dark Knight Rises fell down. Easily my least favorite Christopher Nolan film. But even with that one, there's still so much to recommend even that movie. I mean, it's just that there's so many beautiful things in it, and mm-hmm. there's so many interesting things. The relationship between Christopher Nolan and Batman is very interesting because you can see pretty clearly that Christopher Nolan loves Batman, you know? The other side of it, though, is, of course, this is a very beloved and much scrutinized Warner Brothers property when you get right down to it. Christopher Nolan is, you know, you were mentioning earlier, he's a man who thrives under constraints. Well, talk about the ultimate constraint, which is, of course, being in charge of one of the most beloved fictional characters in the world.
Right.
You know, I mean, what are you going to do? Warner Brothers is going to be on top of him, you know, constantly, every day, all the time, saying, hey, careful.
Yeah.
Don't fuck this up, you know? And he didn't. But at the same time, I think narratively, they're probably his least creative films.
Yeah.
It's just, it's fascinating to me that Batman became the Christopher Nolan project and he, you know, he was able to thrive within that.
One thing the Dark Knight trilogy at least suggested was that this guy can do anything. Mm. Feels that way. He can tell any type of story that he wants to. He can even take a story that's been told and retold and tell it in a way that is interesting and in a way that I appreciated and liked, that I still can't wait for Christopher Nolan's next project, whatever it will be.
And this is something else I was thinking about. Have you ever watched a Christopher Nolan movie only once?
No.
I haven't either. I don't know how you can.
It's a great observation. Yeah, I don't know how you can either.
None of his movies invite only one viewing, I don't think.
No. Part of it goes back to what we've already said, which is, again, the complicated narratives, but then also some of the moments in those films that you want to enjoy again and again, which this is one of the questions I wanted to ask you, which is, do you have a favorite Christopher Nolan moment?
Wow. I mean, to be able to pin it down to one would be really hard.
Just one.
Certainly the moment where Matthew McConaughey looks into infinity and sees every possible instance of his own relationship with his daughter stretching out into an infinite number of timelines.
Yeah.
This is something that I've thought about. I never thought that I would see it. You know, I've thought about this idea, infinite versions of my own self that have made infinite sorts of choices, and to be able to peer into that in some way. I think I've always just sort of hoped that would be part of a quote-unquote afterlife experience that I'd be able to have. When that was actually physically visualized right in front of me, I just thought, oh, how cool that I can live the rest of my life now having seen that moment, you know? Mm-hmm. That's something that's kind of neat.
Bert! No! Bert! No!
Yeah, it's funny because it's not my favorite Christopher Nolan film, but the moment I was thinking of is from Interstellar as well. And it's actually the moment right before that when he's going to go into the wormhole.
Yeah.
He's pulled into the Tesseract.
Yeah.
I remember sitting in the theater, and I saw it in the theater twice. Both times, I just remember thinking, wow, Christopher Nolan is making me believe in the power of cinema. This is real. What I'm watching isn't a construction of any kind. Nobody made this. This is actually happening. It was just such a, like, I just remember that.
Yeah.
It was so crazy. I was like, wow, this is the power of the movies.
Yeah.
And this is why you go to the movies.
Right.
And I think that's something to be said about Christopher Nolan, is he wants you to see his films.
He gives you a reason to go, man. And he gives you a reason to remember. And there's so many, I mean, honestly, I'm thinking back to like Memento, the conclusion of that film, which chronologically is the beginning of the story. But it's still this climactic moment. Guy Pearce, and of course, with his noirish inner monologue, he essentially asked the question at the end, and I'm not quoting it directly, but, you know, am I willing to fool myself in order to give my life a purpose? And I like the fact that he not only asks that question, but he says audibly, yes.
Yeah. Yes.
And then he goes and he does.
So good.
Can I just let myself forget what you've made me do? Do I lie to myself to be happy? In your case, Teddy, yes, I will.
That's such beautiful writing, because I feel like a great writer, but a lesser writer, would leave that open-ended. I think the Nolan brothers see that moment and they say, not right now, though. Not this moment. This is something that we want to give an answer to, because this whole movie has been questions. Let's give an answer to something for once, and let's let it be the answer to a really, really good question. It's a question we all ask ourselves, I think,
yeah,
to a degree, whether it's about our own faith, whether it's about our relationship to our loved ones, or, you know, am I willing to pull the wool over my own eyes in order to save my own sanity, my own sense of purpose? Yes.
Yeah. We all do that to some degree.
So I did want to ask this also, though. Anything that you see in Following, again, maybe he decided to leave out, or things that you're just like, he got better with that, or maybe he kept making that mistake or something. Anything that you thought was on the iffy side with Following that you thought is worth calling out?
Two things come to mind. One, I don't think is fair.
Yeah.
He pulls in such amazing actors now. They were his friends. Some of the acting, I felt like, oh, that was lacking. I mean, I forgive the film for it. The other thing is, I thought there were some... I think he got better at telling complicated stories and realizing what edits were necessary and which ones were superfluous. Like, there were a few jumps in the editing that seemed like a trick.
Like, maybe he was covering something.
Maybe he's covering something, or, you know, he'll show the Bill's face being beaten, and then it'll be what it doesn't even feel like a second quick edit of Bill's face that's fine, and then on to a different...
It's a little showy, maybe.
I think that's probably a good word. It's like the showiness of it, that I felt like he just learned to better use editing as a way of doing what he wants to do.
It's interesting you brought up the acting, because if I'm being perfectly honest, I was actually like, wow, he's actually friends with some good actors back when he was a young man.
I mean, you're an actor, so what the hell do I know?
No. It's just, and I won't say that every performance in there was great. In fact, I want to say...
I love Cobb. I will say that Cobb's...
He was the one that I was actually most intrigued by, and Following is the only thing he's ever been in.
Oh, wow.
Which I found... pretty remarkable, actually, because I thought, here's a guy, I think he could have actually really had a career.
Yeah.
I mean, he was really interesting. If I'm being honest, I think Jeremy Theobald, the main character, I think he actually did a pretty good job. I don't know if you listened to the commentary track.
I didn't.
From Christopher Nolan. He's got a lot of praise, actually, for his actors, especially given the fact that, you know, again, this is a no-budget film, mm-hmm. and, you know, you take what you can get. But put it this way, I think what he was able to pull out of these actors was actually pretty remarkable, mm-hmm. but yeah, clearly the caliber of what he had to work with later was above and beyond anything that he had here. There's really only one thing: the fight scene is there. There's a little, it's a little silly, and it's fight scenes are hard. If you're not an action director, it's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, it was funny. I was reminded of the exact same criticism that people had about The Dark Knight Rises, which was this enormous operatic film. That was one of the things, that there was this huge buildup between this big battle between Batman and Bane, and in this huge confrontation in which Batman eventually gets his back broken.
Sorry, this is like in the sewer.
You're okay. Right. I remember reading reviews that essentially said this was like the most hugely anticipated battle of all time, and it was essentially a 30-second slap fight between two actors who clearly had no idea what fighting was all about.
That's awesome.
And then the movie just kind of moved on. So, you know, I actually think that Nolan is a pretty formidable action director, and I think he does a great job. But yeah, I mean, maybe this hand-to-hand combat thing maybe it's not his very, very best.
He's not going to do like a blood sport or something. Maybe.
Yeah, who knows? End of the day. So Following, definitely not the Christopher Nolan film that probably everyone has seen or heard of, even though this is clearly a legendary director. When you think about Christopher Nolan's body of work. It's interesting to look at that as the very first one and a fairly essential component. So where do you put following?
Man,
you don't want to do that?
No, I have to do it. I mean, this is what we do,
that's
right?
What we do, man.
With Nolan, it feels honestly like what I remember you and Jeff lamenting on the podcast in the Oscar special, which is to rank these films is difficult because it almost, to put it in a place, says it isn't good or isn't worth watching. And, so I think I would probably place Following, not at the bottom of Nolan's work, but down there, I think in the lower half, for sure. I do share the same sentiments about Dark Knight Rises as a whole, as a movie. Again, there are moments I was just blown away by, but I wouldn't say that's my favorite. It's probably my least favorite as well. Yeah. But I find I like Following more than that in terms of it, sure. I think what it's doing and how it succeeds. So that's probably where I'd place it. But again, that's tough. What about you?
Yeah, I would say the same. I would probably put Dark Knight Rises at the bottom. Is the next rung up Following just by virtue of the fact that Nolan had just he had acquired so many superpowers since then and he had the budgets to do what he wanted to do. The movie has such a charm, though.
It does.
You can't really deny the fact that it's just, again, like I said at the front, it's the quintessential freshman film. You see it, and it has this lovingly handmade quality to it that, I don't know, you just like it. Certain Nolan films, I think each time you see them, they get better.
Yeah, I think that's a quality of all of his films.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I would say all of them, but I would say most of them. I've seen Inception a few times. I was just blown away the first time. Scrutinizing it more, there's parts that I think it's still great, but there's things that I have a harder time with.
Okay,
with
so Inception. That kind of loses its luster.
See, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I've seen it a few times. I struggle with, did that particular plot point gain credibility or did it lose credibility on Inception? You know, I don't really know. Personally, I don't know that I would put Inception up there with like a Memento or a Dunkirk or something like that. The logic of that movie is so specific. Like, you know, you have to swallow a lot of ideas that aren't necessarily, they're pretty abstract ideas and they fall apart under a load of scrutiny, but maybe that's okay.
But I'm curious if you had to place Nolan films.
Like what are the top?
Yeah, what are the top three? And not necessarily saying 1, 2, 3, what would you rank there?
I just don't think that I've ever had a more inspiring Nolan experience than Memento. Mm-hmm. It's not just that it's such a work of art and it's just so well done and all that. It was just such a shift for, I think, film in general. Oh, we can do that. Mm-hmm. You know, the world was still in love with Pulp Fiction. Mm-hmm. We love the fact that it's told out of order and it's so interesting. Memento was the first time we'd seen that device used in a movie where it wasn't just, here's an interesting way to tickle your brain. It was like you have to tell it backwards or else the film doesn't even work.
Mm-hmm.
Man, it was just such a brilliant device. It was this found experiment that just worked on every level. So I don't know that you can get better than that. There's certain films that just get better each time. Memento, Interstellar, you know, maybe The Prestige. It's hard to beat these movies.
That's good.
Do you have a favorite?
Well, I'd say Memento is my favorite as well. I just can't even describe that weekend. When I discovered Memento, right? And that was my world for those 3 days of watching the movie over and over again.
Yeah. You know what I like picturing is him trying to get money together for Memento and having the studio say, all right, here's the deal. We'll give you all the money you need, but you know what's really big right now is this movie. It's called The Matrix. I think we can get you like 2 actors from that one. Can you get 2 of the Matrix actors in there?
I mean, that was a favorite. The Prestige is also one that I mean, aside from Memento, which I've seen so many times, The Prestige is one I constantly go back to.
Yeah.
And Interstellar, I've only seen twice in the theater.
Yeah.
But both times were like such an amazing experience. It's a Nolan film, and given that I've seen it only twice, I'm not sure I would place it yet up so high.
Yeah.
But I love The Dark Knight. Such a wonderful, wonderfully well-told crime saga, you know, and I love that. Memento, though, it's, like you said, it's hard to beat.
Yeah. I wish I could relate to people that haven't seen it how interesting a film you're in for if you decide to take on following a recommended film. 100%,
yeah.
As far as I'm concerned. Yeah, absolutely. You not only need to watch Following, you need to watch it and then watch it again. You're completely cheating yourself out of a great experience if you only watch it once.
Yep.
And quite frankly, I think you'll just be frustrated.
Yeah.
And Christopher Nolan even admits this in the commentary track that he does for the film. You know, he points out virtually every scene means something different the second time you watch it. You watch it that second time, you think, by God, that's true.
It's so true. I mean, I recommend it too. I think it is a must watch. You'll be surprised how many things you as a viewer can locate that he continues to do, his films, and I think similar themes that he's constantly exploring.
Well, Daniel, I think that's it for this episode then of the Freshman 15. Christopher Nolan, his freshman film, Following, low-budget/no-budget black and white puzzle piece film that will tickle your brain. It'll stick with you. It'll make you want to watch it again. You'll have to watch it again if you have any interest at all in these characters, and I suspect that you will, particularly for someone with absolutely no feature film experience, no Hollywood street cred, no anything. He actually made himself quite an impressive little debut.
So, of course, we'd love to hear from you, and you can find us on Facebook, on Instagram. You can email us at freshman15film@gmail.com. That's freshman15film@gmail.com. Of course, you heard in this episode that we do take correspondence seriously, and we want to engage with you. So feel free to drop us a line and let us know what you think about anything we might have said, things you think we got wrong. We want to hear you. We'd love if you took the opportunity to rate us on iTunes. It helps people find us and with our search results, so that people can enjoy what you enjoy.
And I'm glad you brought up Facebook, Daniel, because, you know, again, the benefits just keep rolling in. If you're a Facebook follower of the Freshman 15, you'll see that even just for this past episode, we released another piece of bonus content. Jeff Jensen talking about Dune. Only if you were a Facebook follower of the Freshman 15 are you able to listen to that kind of goodness. But even beyond that, I'll tell you, Daniel, again and again, these freshman films, some of which are very difficult to find, I find that the only place that they are available is through a streaming service that I subscribe to, I know you subscribe to, and that's called Filmstruck. If you're not a member of Filmstruck, what are you waiting for? It's a terrific curator of many of the Criterion Collection films, but also even beyond that, great films, classic films, directors that you aren't going to see on any of the major streaming services like Hulu or Netflix or anything, which are all fine services. Filmstruck, though, is the place you want to go to find some of the greatest films in film history. So, oh, and of course, if you want to see Following with director's commentary or Following extras that you would see only on the Criterion Collection disc otherwise, or Following recut to be told in order, all these things are all available on Filmstruck, and those sorts of alternate takes and commentaries and all those kinds of things, I don't know, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, Daniel, I don't know anywhere where you can get a service like that for really any film. This is really specific to this service.
Filmstruck for me is a place, if I don't know what I want to watch, it's a place I go to say, okay, what should I watch? Right? And I think that is one of the things that I love and appreciate about Filmstruck.
Yeah. Anyway, enough of all that. Listen, thank you very much for joining us for this episode. We really appreciate it. Till next time, I'm Jeremy Bear.
And I'm Daniel Long.
We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening. Skitter, no, I said, get out.